Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Mickey and Roger? Yeah. Derek and A-Rod? No. Lou and the Babe? Somewhere in between. Teammates don't have to be friends, and you can understand how they might not be, especially if they're both superstars. Tony Castro takes up this topic in his newest book, Garrick and the Babe, The Friendship and the Feud. The results are mixed, at least to someone who grew up reading biographies that never looked under the covers, and I don't just mean that metaphorically. On the one hand, the book is well-researched and presents lots of heretofore unreported information. On the other hand, it certainly shatters long-held images of these Hall of Famers. I asked Castro about the difficulties of bringing such stories to the reading public. Tony Castro, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me on, Ron.
So it's been 70 years since the passing of Babe Ruth, which kind of explains the glut of books coming out on him this year. But your book takes a very specific look at the relationship between the Babe and Lou Gehrig. So, well, why did you decide to publish this book?
Several reasons, but the biggest was that I had this book in me for some time after I did the Mickey Mantle book back in 2002, and at that time I put it aside for a number of different reasons, and then here a few years ago I thought, wow, okay, this is still there and still viable. I figured somebody else would do this book, and nobody did, and so it was there. I had a lot of the material a friend of mine who had passed away had been the honorary mayor of Hollywood, and he had contributed a great deal to my understanding of Ruth. With he had been a Babe Ruth fan and a friend of Babe's, and is you know, from 42 up until 48 when Babe died. And I thought, wow, you know, I can introduce this in here because this puts a lot of things in context, and that's the prologue of the book. And so it was that. It was, I think it hadn't worked itself through in my head enough in those years that I had, because I wrote Mantle in 2002, and we'd actually had a contract for this book in 2003, with the same company, Brassey's Books. They went out of business, and so, the book just kind of, lay there for, 10, 15 years.
So it actually worked out well for you because, you know, people love anniversaries. Even if it's an anniversary of a sad event, it brings issues back into the public eye. What do people think about the friendship between – there's an assumption that because these guys were teammates, they were friends, but more and more we're hearing that wasn't the case.
Yeah. I mean, that's what prompted me to take on the book when I was finishing the Mantle book. Good friend of mine who was a big basketball fan out here. I live in Los Angeles, and so we used to go to the Laker games together. And Kobe and Shaq were great teammates on a great team. And my friend who covered the Lakers says to me, says, people don't realize these guys hate each other. And this was before the feud really erupted and before Shaq was dealt away. And so that was part of it. And I think as long as it took to for the Shaq and Kobe feud to erupt into the public spotlight in a day of the 24-hour news cycle and you know, ESPN and things like that, imagine what it was back in those days when sports writing was an entirely different kind of form. I mean, you didn't go into people's personal lives, and so it's not that other biographies of Ruth and Gehrig haven't alluded to this feud. It's just that they haven't gone into any great detail. They glossed over it. But it was significant, and I think it's much like myself. I grew up reading Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig biographies from the time I was a little kid. I don't remember this being in there, and it never occurred to me that two things. One, that these guys had such a relationship that I think it was funny the other day in one way that the New York Daily News said that it was that I described a relationship that was more at home at page six than it was on the sports pages, but that's probably true. And so we're back to that, you know, that Ruth and Garrick were not the teammates we expect them to be, kind of like Jeter and Rodriguez back in their heyday. Although that one wasn't as personal, I think, as this one here with Ruth and Garrick.
Now, the linchpin in this one seems to be focused, if I read this correctly, on Garrick's mother. Would you say
Garrick's
that's fair?
Mom, that's fair. I mean, she puts all Little League fathers to shame. Not in the sense that, you know, we as Little League fathers, good and bad, you know, just hover over our kids from the time they're, you know, big enough to throw a ball, maybe until they're in high school or so, if they're fortunate enough to play high school ball. But Lou's mom went with Lou to spring training with the Yankees for several years. She was there the entire time. Lou lived with his parents until he married Eleanor, until he moved out to marry Eleanor. It was an uncomfortable relationship to really look into because I kept expecting to find something that I didn't want to find, and fortunately I didn't. But it was like, wow, this woman was the consummate stage mom. And so, yeah, it was this lady who, there was a good side to her. She loved, Ruth's, youngest daughter. At that time, the world was led to believe she was the adopted daughter of Ruth and his, first wife who had died in a terrible fire in Massachusetts. And so this little girl, Dorothy, was was Christina Gehrig's, daughter that she didn't have nearby, let's say. And so the feud erupted over her making comments, of Christina Gehrig making disparaging comments about the way she felt that Claire Ruth, Ruth's second wife, was treating this daughter that was a stranger to her, more or less. I mean, she didn't, Claire Ruth, Babe Ruth's second wife, was this woman who had been like a debutante in Georgia and dressed perfectly. She looked like a woman who had stepped out of a fashion magazine even at that time. And her daughter, she had her own daughter from a previous marriage. She dressed her exactly the same way. While Dorothy, this daughter who came from Ruth's first marriage, the adopted daughter from that first marriage, was always dressed in overalls and was like a tomboy and certainly didn't appear to have the suave look about her that the other daughter did. So it was these comments that she made about how Claire Ruth may or may not have been handling and loving her other daughter that upset Claire, who in turn turned to Ruth, and Ruth confronted Garrick about this, and it led to a separation of several years.
Now, you had mentioned that you were hoping not to find something in the relationship between Garrick and his mother, and I couldn't help thinking as I was reading your book, boy, these things have certainly changed since the biographies we read when we were kids, or at least I read when I was a kid. And even more recent biographies about Ruth, there's a lot of allusion to his sexual escapades. But as you also say, in those days, they didn't write about personal, in the older days, even a generation before books by Lee Montville and Robert Creamer, they didn't write about such things. But you don't seem to have any problem with mentioning the sexual aspects in a little bit greater detail than we're used to.
Well, it's changed. I mean, biography writing, just like newspaper writing, has changed a great deal in my lifetime. I went into the newspaper business right out of college in 1970, and there was an entirely different culture of how you handled, let's say, politicians' wives, lives, and the relationship with their wives. I mean, the way it was handled, let's say, with Kennedy and Johnson, and just not reported as the way it is, it has been in more recent years, you know, going back to the Clinton years and even today. I mean, it's become fodder for political reporting. If you can't handle going into people's personal lives, I guess there's no room for you.
But you started writing circles. You say you started working on this book more than a decade ago. Was this always your intention?
Well, I think that biography and writing biographies had changed by that time. Mm-hmm. It started changing. I mean, I found myself having left a number of things out of the Mickey Mantle biography that I would have put in there if I were writing it today. Several years later, almost 15 years later, I did a book titled Dommage and Mick that came out a couple of years ago, and there was an entirely different. I was able to use some of the material that I didn't use in writing the 2002 book, because in 2002 book, part of it may have been the editor that I had who didn't want certain things in there. The other part was, even at that time, some of these things weren't handled that way. And today, you get, I think there have been a couple of biographies since mine that have gone into more detail about Mantle's personal life.
Well, with Mantle was a generation removed from Ruth and DiMaggio. Well, not so much DiMaggio, because they were contemporaries for a very brief time.
But sports writers didn't go into Mantle's personal life when he was drinking and carousing mm-hmm. back in the 50s. And if it hadn't been for Jim Boughton's book in the 60s that went into some of this, some of this would never have, the culture of looking at certainly at Mantle, but other athletes might never have changed. And in fact, Jim Boughton for a long time was a pariah for having gone into the personal, exposing some of the personal life exploits of Mickey and others on that Yankees team of the 50s and 60s.
Do you think it's because baseball is, not to over-romanticize it, it's the national pastime. It's a very romantic sport as opposed to, let's say, Hollywood celebrities. You know, people are always writing about the love life of Hollywood celebrities. But in baseball, it seems we want our heroes to be more pure.
Well, I think we wanted them at one point, but they certainly never were. I mean, you've got the rate of Hall of Fame that's, you know, you've got racists and wife beaters in the Hall of Fame, and Pete Rose can't get into the Hall of Fame for simply betting on some games. Wrong as it was, you know, our rights and wrongs and our sometimes perhaps should be examined and clarified a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, you know, Ty Cobb was hardly an exemplary All-American boy.
What about, and again, when it comes to working on the book, writing it throughout the many drafts you must have done, what about self-censorship? Was there any point where you said, gee, you know, maybe I really should leave this out, or are you more of a everything gets in type of writer?
No, everything gets in type of writer. I would have done some of the things differently on all of these books. On this one, it's not like these people were bad men. And what I alluded to as far as the relationship between Garrick and his mom is that it was a relationship that really bordered on, I wouldn't say incest, but certainly on what in the world's going on here, that a man this age is, you know, lives and dies on the word of his mom. She broke up several of his romantic relationships when he was in his 20s, some that he was very serious about. And she tried to do that with Eleanor, and what came down to Eleanor marrying Garrick was that Eleanor was living with the Garricks for a short while just before they got married, and they would be at the dinner table, and Mrs. Garrick would start a conversation in German, which Henry, the father, would join in German, and Lou would be speaking in German. Meanwhile, sitting at the other chair is Eleanor, who can't understand nor speak German. And this would go on for much of the evening. Finally, I think it had to do something about the drapes that Eleanor had picked out for the apartment that they were moving into, that Mrs. Garrick, nixed them and said, you know, those just won't work. And Eleanor got angry and stormed. stormed out, moved out the next day. Gary had to chase her down to the apartment where they were moving into and say, look, you know, let's get married right now. And they did.
The relationship between Garrick and his parents, how close would you say, within taking into consideration when The Pride of the Yankees was produced, how close would you say that is to accuracy?
As close as anything else Hollywood produces, especially nowadays. And you have to remember, though, on The Pride of the Yankees, the studio had given Eleanor full power to veto anything that was in there or to introduce anything that she saw and wanted in there. And according to Eleanor's biography, she was invited to a couple of screenings. She went to one of them, and she came out of there in tears, feeling like this was the perfect movie. So if we judge by Eleanor, if there had been something in or left out that she felt disturbed about, she didn't speak up.
Just briefly, as we close this conversation, you write about the relationship between Garrick and DiMaggio, and quoting from your book, together Garrick and DiMaggio would develop a chemistry that never existed between Lou and Babe. Well, was there no chemistry between Lou and Babe, even in the early years?
Well, you know, Babe at that time, to fans, to a lot of sports writers, and even to himself, Babe wasn't just a sports hero. Babe was like a Christ. He was a god, and he that was certainly the opinion he had of himself. And so anything around Babe centered around Babe. And so much so that Babe had a difficult time remembering people's names. He would know people for years and still call them kid, you know, his distinctive kid thing. Johnny Grant, who is the Hollywood friend of his that I alluded to earlier, he knew Johnny for several years because Los Angeles and Hollywood was Ruth's second home, both during his playing years, after his playing years, and up until he became really too sick. And so he would spend a great deal of time out here, and Johnny said, you know, he can't remember a time when Babe didn't call him anything but kid.
But Garrick, with his personality, seemed to be okay in playing second banana.
I think that was just part of his DNA, that I don't think he hung on Ruth's word, nor should he have. And as opposed to what happened with him and DiMaggio, you know, he was the it was his team when DiMaggio joined the Yankees, and he's the one that you know, DiMaggio's rookie year, DiMaggio came up and he burnt himself sitting under a sun lamp, I think it was, and actually didn't play for the first 2 or 3 weeks of that season. And Garrick consoled him about this and explained to him, you know, look, I was with the Yankees for 2 years and thought I wasn't going to be able to ever start. And I had my chance, and, you know, yours is waiting out there for you, effectively, is what he said to him.
Considering everything you said, was this a hard book for you to write? Not physically, not mentally, but like more emotionally. Was this a difficult book for you to write?
It became emotional only in this sense, that in the last few months of writing this, I learned that an old friend of mine was dying of, effectively, was something I didn't know. I thought it was something else that somebody said. I don't know why they hid this from me, but it turned out to be ALS. Mm. And she died in her mid-50s, and it was like, whoa, God, what she must have gone through. And then hearing from her loved ones of what she went through. And this really said in me, wow, what Garrick must have done, and especially in his to hide it the way he did in those the last year or so that he played with the Yankees. I mean, just an incredible act of courage.
And we've been talking with Tony Castro, author of the new book, Garrick and the Babe, The Friendship and the Feud, published by Triumph. Tony, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Tony Castro. Visit the website for news on the next guest from the world of baseball literature and or pop culture. And for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews, seems kind of redundant now to say it, but visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com. And remember, if you have a question or suggestion, drop me a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. So long, everybody.
Sat in the stand, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand. He'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.